Going to begin tonight with a new subject. Now, we've looked at the historical background to the various developments leading up to the time of the founding of America, the popular theories throughout history that also have been somewhat of an influence in America. We're coming now to the time of the founding of America, the development of America, and the structure of the Constitution. That's the end of this program that we have been dealing with in A Christian Political Philosophy. Tonight we want to take a look at the political philosophy of the Puritans, and we want to deal tonight extensively with that structure of political thought. By way of introduction, if I can, Dr. Lorraine Bittner writes, and I quote, "It is estimated that of the 3 million Americans at the time of the American Revolution, 900,000 were Scotch or Scotch-Irish origin, 600,000 were Puritan English, and 400,000 were German or Dutch Reformed. In addition to this, the Episcopalians had a Calvinistic confession in their 39 articles, and many French Huguenots also had come to this Western world. Thus, we see that about two-thirds of the colonial population had been trained in the school of Calvin," unquote. Calvinism was the predominant theology of the Protestant churches of America and Europe. The creeds of the various denominations are telling as to who theology permeated their confessions. The Helvetic, which is the Swiss creed, is all structured after Calvin's theology. The Heidelberg Confession, which was the German creed, it has Calvin's theology. The Gallican Confession, which is the French, I believe I spelled that right, the French creed was all Calvinistic. The 39 Articles of the Church of England, the Episcopal Creed, it is strongly influenced by Calvinistic doctrine. The Belgic Confession, which was the Dutch Creed. The Westminster Confession, which was held by the Presbyterian Church. The Savoy Confession, which was the Congregational Church. The Baptist Confession of 1689 in England. All of these confessions, including the Philadelphia Confession of Faith in America, the New Hampshire Confession of Faith of the Baptist in America, all these creeds go back to one man's system of theology. Now, it was his system. It was not his theology. It was the theology of Paul. It was the theology of Christ. It is the theology of God. And this man simply systematized it in such a way that it made it presentable and clear as to the teaching of God's holy word. Calvinism was the driving force behind the political philosophy of early colonial America. Patriotism was birthed out of the pulpits of the Calvinistic pulpits in America. That's why America had patriots, because they were trained in the law and theology of the Genevan theologian. Again, I quote Dr. Bittner, who states, "When the founding fathers of our republic sat down to frame a system of representative and popular government," says Dr. E.W. Smith, and he's quoting here, "their task was not so difficult as some have imagined. They had a model to work by. If the average American citizen were asked who was the founder of America, the true author of our great republic, he might be puzzled to answer. We can imagine his amazement at hearing the answer given to this question by the famous German historian Rank, one of the profoundest scholars of modern times. Says Rank, John Calvin was the virtual founder of America." Unquote. Throughout the history, early history, up until the time that we've had all the liberal historians now writing, John Calvin has been pointed out over and over and over again of the man who literally established the republics that were established throughout Europe and America. It was his political system, his thinking in these areas. And what made his system so, if you will, important to the people? It was a system that was not that which had been traditionally set forth that eventually developed into tyranny. It did not see man or people as the sovereigns, but it recognized God as the sovereign, and it recognized one law for all people, and all men standing just and equal before that law. And so it was Calvin's teaching, his views of the church, his views of government, permeated all throughout the Reformation, the totality of Europe, and also permeated and was carried over into the founding of the American colonies. Merle D'Aubigné, the great Lutheran historian, writes, "Calvin was the founder of the greatest of republics. The pilgrims who left their country in the reign of James I and landing on the barren soil of New England founded populous and mighty colonies were his sons. His direct and legitimate sons. And the American nation which we have seen growing so rapidly boasts as its father the humble reformer on the shores of Lake Leman." Unquote. The great, perhaps maybe the greatest church historian, D'Aubigné, says, no one can lay claim to the founding of America more than John Calvin. What we have seen established and built must go back to the humble reformer in Geneva. Dr. E.W. Smith says, and I quote, "These revolutionary principles of republican liberty and self-government taught and embodied in the system of Calvin were brought to America, and in this new land where they have borne so mighty a harvest were planted by whose hands? The hands of the Calvinist." The hands of the Calvinist. Every aspect of early America is entrenched in the theology of John Calvin. It permeated the totality of life, the thinking. That's not to say that everything was totally Calvinistic, but at the heart of the people in their heritage, in their thinking, that theology which governed their actions, the foundation of that came from the great Swiss theologian John Calvin. He was French, by the way, but he was living in Switzerland. The great American historian George Bancroft, though not a Calvinist, states that Calvin was the father of America. And he who will not honor this memory and respect the influences of Calvin knows but little of the origin of American liberty. Unquote. And there are just countless cases, you can go on and cite them and research them if you would like, who simply go back and say, if you're going to understand America, you've got to go back to the Reformation and to John Calvin to understand it. There is the foundation. And if you do not understand John Calvin and what took place at Geneva and his political views and influences, it's sure that you will not understand what took place in Europe during the Reformation and thereafter, and it's sure that you will not understand the origins of America. And the people who came and settled America and structured the government of America, you just will not be able to understand that. There is no divorcing of the theology of the life of the people that founded America. Their theology was clear and distinctive. They were the reformers of the new land. They came here to found a new country. By the way, John Cotton... If you remember, Bill Higgins made mention of this, and it probably didn't stick in your mind at the time, but John Cotton, who was a Puritan coming to America to help to establish the Massachusetts colony, Bay Colony, told the people, "This is the new Canaan, and we need new Israelites to settle God's promised land." Remember, that, he said, was one of the unfortunate things, because they did view America as being the land of Canaan, and therefore their purpose was to drive the wicked out. And so they had a lot of those things that took place that were not quite well done, because they had a different approach that really didn't apply to them as much as they should have dealt from a different perspective. But that's how they seen America. They seen it as the land of opportunity to come and to build their Christian republics. Their opportunity to come to advance the kingdom of God. And we're going to see that tonight as we go through all the various teachings and a lot of the law structure stuff that I've dug up this last week at the University of Florida College of Law. We're going to look at those systems, their thinking, and all of that that took place within the structure of the American system. American history is a history which cannot be separated, nor its political overtures, from the theological influence from its inception. From the founding fathers to the development of this great nation, the historical Christian orthodoxy, that is, Puritanism, Calvinism, was clearly stamped on every facet of our political views. And even until this day, there are still remnants of the political Calvinistic thinking still in many areas of our society. It has been earth-shaking. It has remained. Even though the system, the people, and their heritage died, though they be dead, their theology still speaks, even though they're still trying to cut it down to where it doesn't speak any longer. The Puritans, they left England. They came to America so that they could be governed by their faith and to worship the God of the Bible without statist interference. The fallacy behind the separation of church and state is constructed today is not the political views of the Puritans when they came to America, and neither is it their political views, and we'll see that the church should run the state. They never held to that position. That's a false position. The Puritans had no intention of the church running the state or the state running the church whatsoever. They did not see those institutions as one institution running the other. They seen them both as ministers of God, both under the law of God, both to fulfill their proper duties, and the two were not to mingle in the responsibilities of executing their duties that God has set forth. There are areas that they absolutely overlap, but they do not carry out the same function. They are two different functions. And so we go back to what Bill Higgins reminded us so kindly of. Where did the Puritans go wrong? They went wrong in the hands of the historians. That's where they went wrong. So many of them maligned them, and they taught things that were just absolutely false about these people. We have this so-called Puritan tag when you do something and people say, "Well, you're Puritan." That is the utter shame word to be tagged with in America. "Well, you're just a Puritan." And in reality, these people, they were not, and they did not live the kind of life of drudgery and of remorse. They had a life that was promising. They had hope. They were involved in art, literature. They did all kinds of things. They were a very expressive people. They're the people that gave us the shape of what America soon became in its construction in the day of developing the Constitution. Puritanism is the key to understanding our heritage in America, and Dr. Greg Singer writes, and I quote, "Puritanism, the prevailing theological and philosophical system, not only in England but in most of the colonies founded during the 17th century, is the key which unlocks the meaning of colonial history as a whole. It pervaded not only the religious life and thought of most of the early colonists, but their political, social, and economic life as well. Nothing could be more misleading than the contemporary notion that Puritanism was little more than a, quote, Sunday religion, which had little or no influence on the daily life of those who professed it. The direct opposite was actually the case, for it permeated colonial life to an amazing degree, not only in New England, but in the colonies to the south as well. The Puritan influence was not lacking in the founding of Virginia and the Carolina colonies. For most of the colonies along the Atlantic seaboard, Calvinism was a kind of theological common denominator which gave great consistency and coherence to colonial life as a whole. Unquote. The whole structure, and you have to go back and understand, because we're going to be moving politically to the legal system in America. The thing you've got to understand is, while the colonies had different areas in which they viewed the legal system, and they brought in various legal systems, each from different aspects or looking from different points of view, while that may be true to some extent, the underlying thing that you must realize, and what Dr. Singer has pointed out, is that they were all in common at one point. They were common understanding and belief concerning the doctrines of John Calvin. Now, if they understood, and that's all that must be established, and I think Dr. Singer, being one of the greater American historians living yet, has fairly well done and documented. If they all understood that, they understood the theology of Calvin, then did they understand who the true sovereign was? Without question. Because John Calvin says there can be but one sovereign, and it is the God of heaven. And so, throughout the colonies, we would have to say, in their religious life, and without question, what they believed and lived in faith had to affect other areas of their life, they could not, they did not, and they would not accept men, kings, or governments as sovereign. The telling story of that is the fact that in the Constitution, you do not have, or in the Declaration of Independence, you do not have the term sovereignty even mentioned. And that is important to take note of. Because they still were living under the influence of their founding fathers when they constructed that document. And they understood not we the people, not the government, nor a monarch could claim sovereignty. No one but God can make laws. And that's an important point. And they understood that, and that's why we do not have such terminology found in our Constitution and Declaration of Independence. Had they not been taught under Calvin's system, they would have written it under the influence of one of the other political philosophers of his time. And they would have established, we are either sovereign, or the king is sovereign, or somebody's sovereign. But the negative aspect, if you will, and you might say it's the silent witness, is the fact that there is no assent to sovereignty claimed. We might say in the Lockean scheme of things that we the people to some extent might have been a claim of sovereignty, but it does not say that. And there are a lot who argue that very point. The fact is, saying we the people does not convey sovereignty. You would have to construe that awfully hard through a different set of circumstances other than the historical understanding of the intent of the founders and their influence theologically in the colonies. So it'd be very hard to construe that any other way. Because you're going to have to go back to the historians, you're going to have to go back to those people who lived, who wrote, and who taught, and what their theology taught plays a major important role in understanding what it is that we have in this country when we've seen this country established and structured politically. In England, the church was owned by the state, and the king was the head of the church, And the king was also the tyrant of the people. He was the oppressor. Now, if you don't know how to determine how the king is the tyrant, Jack, last week, gave me a great understanding of how you know when you're in tyranny. When you're on the good ship America, everybody gets the privilege of rowing. You get your oar, that's the free part you get. You get to row and shut up and just row and do what you're told. That's freedom. But you know when tyranny takes place is when the king says, I want a water ski. Then the tyranny begins. So look out. When you're out rowing and the king says, I want a water ski, and then he decides, I want a high-powered type water ski system, you're in trouble. Because you're going to do some real rowing. In England, eventually, the king became tyrannical. Totally. We see it over and over and over again. And the king and parliament warring back and forth over sovereign power and rule. As a result of that, the king, splitting from the Roman Catholic Church, as Bill had told us, comes back. He's the head of the church. He's the head of the country. He is the sovereign. He runs his courts. He runs his church courts. He runs his admiralty courts. He's just got the whole ball of wax. He's got the judicial system in his pocket. He basically rules and reigns as he sees fit. The Puritans could see where the king was going with this. And the Puritans seen an opportunity to come to America. And we'll get to that later on down the line, how they came here. And there's some peculiar circumstances surrounding how they got their charter to come here and exactly what took place in their move to get here. It's a very kind of interesting story, to say the least. So then, with the founding of New England came a hope and a desire for the Puritans and their children, and even their children's children, that they could live under God's law according to the Bible, and thereby be pleasing to God in every area of their life. What they wanted to establish was, without question, a biblical commonwealth. Maybe it wasn't so structured to such a degree that it could be shown that, but that was their desire. We want to live in the heritage of what we believe God demands of us. Not just in church on Sunday, but what He demands of our life on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, on Thursday, on Friday, and on Saturday. And in order to be able to live that to its fullest development, we must have a political scheme, an economic scheme, everything that correlates to that theology. And therefore, they were desirous of building the kingdom of God. They were desirous of coming and establishing a system in which God's law reigns supreme on every issue of life. That was their motivating force. That's what drove them here. They were not yet to the point so persecuted that they had to leave. They seen it as an opportunity to advance the kingdom and to come and to build a new life and a new future for them and their children and the freedom to worship God. The Puritan cry, if you remember, in early Puritan America was, and if you will, it was also in England, the crown rights of King Jesus. What was the battle cry? The crown rights of King Jesus. Everything belongs under one crown. And that crown sits on the head of Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God. He is the sovereign. That was their declaration. In America, in American colonial Puritanism, theology, without question, was the queen of the sciences. It set the tone for the total way of life. Again, I quote Dr. Singer, who states, "The Puritans of New England went therefore, the express purpose of setting up a commonwealth which would give full expression to that world and life view inherent in their Calvinistic theology. This was to be reflected not only in their political activity, but in the economic and social life as well.
At the heart of this political, social, and economic philosophy lay a theology, Calvinism. Puritanism was thus a theological interpretation of life. And in Calvinism, the Puritans found the guide for their economic, social, and political conduct. Thus, it was necessary that its content should be clearly derived and widely understood not only by the ecclesiastical and political leadership of the colony, but by the church members at large who were, at the same time, the voting citizens of the state. The widespread knowledge of and appreciation for the theological foundations of the Puritan way of life was absolutely necessary if the biblical commonwealth being erected in Massachusetts Bay were to endure. Those who had the responsibility for choosing the leadership in both church and state must clearly recognize the importance of their role and clearly discern those who were properly qualified to serve in these capacities. This necessity lies at the center of the often ridiculed but seldom understood requirement that only church members in good standing could vote for those who would lead both the church and the state. A theological enlightened electorate was as vitally necessary for the state as a biblically oriented membership was for the church. Orthodoxy of religious belief was, therefore, a prime requisite for participation in this way of life, because theology lay at the very heart of their entire system. It was this conscious application of a Calvinistic theology to the whole structure of life which gave to New England its dominant position in the intellectual life of the colonies. Calvinism gave to this section a character which would survive to some degree even after the passing of three centuries. While the rise of heresies and the incessant attacks of many of its enemies would cause it to lose its lofty dominance, traces of its influence would still be discernible in the mid-20th century. What Dr. Singer has described to you is exactly what was taking place in that colonial time period. The Puritans, especially in New England, were so involved into their life, established from Scripture. Who could ever conceive of having a political system? Or who could ever conceive of having an economic system or a social system that would not be governed by the law of God, if that was their ultimate law and if Christ was their absolute sovereign king unto whom they owed all their allegiance? And who could conceive in such a system anyone voting for church officers or state magistrate offices who was not a member of good standing in the church? That would be ludicrous in that type of society. Why would you let the pagan vote for that which he does not understand? How can he who hates God understand good government? I think that's apparent in America, because we sure don't have good leaders in America who have anything to do with the God of the Bible. Very few up there. And we fight to keep a few of them in office every time they come up for election. And the Puritans realized that. And they put it as an important part of their system. You see, everything's entrenched in their life, because their life is their theology. They lived what they believed. That's what's important. They implemented what they believed. Of all the things that historians and people can criticize the Puritans for, they cannot say they didn't live what they believed, because they absolutely carried it out to the fullest end. There was no question in their mind, they not only must believe what the Bible says, but they must apply it to their life.
That's what made the Puritans great. They were people of commitment. They weren't willing to sell out at any price. They were committed to a total way of life. Would to God we had that kind of people in America today who would be committed to such a way of life. But we don't. The failure of American theology to maintain the theological orthodoxy of Calvinism has given way to the demise of the political philosophy of modern America. Truly, the state of the nation, morally, politically, economically, socially, theologically, is only a mere reflection of the state of the church today. What else could it be? You see, if you go back and you look at the Puritan church and the people who were a part of that church, and if you look at their way that they lived and their life and the way they governed themselves and the way they ruled, the way that they lived economically, socially, you see their church and you can see exactly what their way of life, their government, their society, their culture was going to be. Their culture was a reflection of the church. It was a reflection of their life and theology. And the same is true in today in America. You look at the church and you look at our society and you can say, I can trace the roots of our modern apostasy, be it politically, economically, socially, I can trace it right back to the church. Because as the church goes, so goes the society, so goes the culture. That is the problem. We came up with theologies that no longer committed us to a way of life pleasing to God, but they committed us to a life of lawlessness. That's what we got committed to. You see, it's much more than saying, I believe these things to be true. It's much, much more to say, yeah, I believe in the law of Moses. I believe we ought to apply the general equity of the law of Moses into our society. That sounds good. And then we don't live it. You see, the Puritans would be disgusted with that. They would say, you're only giving lip service to God. And He doesn't want lip service. He wants obedience. And that was their commitment. We must be obedient to the directives of the God of the Bible. That proved their good faith, practice, and belief. They lived by the directives of the law, the true law of the true King. They could never be accused of not living what they believed, because every facet of their life was tied into their theology and in their commitment to Christ and His kingdom. So we should make our lives committed to Him. Do you have any questions over this introduction?